Today is Fred Day Lewis. Fred is a research hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Earth Systems Processes Division in the Hydrogeophysics Branch, where he conducts research, technology transfer, and training to support the application of geophysical methods to groundwater supply and remediation problems across the nation. I actually saw Fred give a learning lab on these tools at the Battelle Conference earlier this year and thought that this would make a great webinar for us. So we brought Fred on today to get this information out to more of you. So thank you all for joining. And I want to remind anyone that is listening through the phone line, make sure you keep yourself on mute, not on hold. And with that, I am ready to turn it over to Fred. Fred, if you're all set, please begin.
Okay, thank you, Cindy. I want to thank the EPA for the opportunity to talk to you today about geophysical method selection and how we match study goals, method capabilities, and limitations with site conditions. Before we even begin, though, I'd like to start off with a poll and get your thoughts on what do you think is the greatest impediment to using geophysics more widely, and what is that greatest impediment to its widespread and effective use? The possible answers here, and there's no right answer. This is a survey, not a right wrong answer kind of question. Are A, cost versus benefit; B, the lack of information or training to select the right geophysical methods or tools; C, end users often don't know how to use the geophysical results; or D, bad experiences, instances where geophysics hasn't worked. So if you are in the webinar, you can click on the appropriate answer, what you think. Please do that now, and we'll talk about that just for a moment.
Okay. If you can't see that, if you can't see the window for the poll where to add your answer in, you may need to shrink down your screen using that little four arrow button up in the upper right corner, and then you should be able to see the poll window. Okay, Fred, it looks like we have most of our answers in. So what we are looking at is, still a few changing. Maybe people are changing their answers. What we have is 26% said cost versus benefit, 42.5% said lack of information or training to select the right geophysical methods or tools. 27.5% said end users often don't know how to use the geophysical results, and about just shy of 4% said bad experiences where geophysics hasn't worked.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. So it's pretty split across the first three answers, and only 4% saying bad experiences, which is good news to me, because in a lot of my work, I hear about those bad experiences. People come to us and say, geophysics didn't work at my site. And in discussing with those folks about what the geophysical methods were used for, we often come to find that the wrong method was used, or the method that was used had really no hope of answering the question that was posed at that particular site. So all four of these questions or four of these impediments are things that I hope to address today in the material that I present to you, and I hope also to provide you with some tools and resources that you, your collaborators, your contractors can look to help deal with these issues, to help evaluate cost versus benefit before you begin the work, to give you the information that you need to select the right geophysical tool, to let the end users know better how they might use the geophysical results, and to prevent these bad experiences or black eyes from occurring where geophysics is being used in instances where it either shouldn't or it just can't really answer the questions that are posed. So I'll begin today by talking about what we call at my office the geophysical toolbox. This is a term that we've been using for over 20 years now at the Hydrogeophysics Branch, formerly the Office of Groundwater Branch of Geophysics. I'll talk about why geophysics, and that is I'll try to motivate the use of geophysics for various problems related to the environment, water quality, water supply, and other problems. I'll talk a little bit about the information that's provided by various geophysical methods, but I won't have time to dig into any particular method in any great detail. We'll discuss the trade-off between scale and resolution when selecting methods, and then we'll go over method selection. And I'll show you a tool, the Fractured Rock Geophysical Toolbox Method Selection Tool, to assist in selecting methods for use at your sites. And then we'll talk briefly about what's called a feasibility assessment for geophysics. The idea here being that even before you go to the field, once you do have a method selected to use, you can do a kind of computational gut check on whether that method can answer the questions that you've got posed. So whether it can see a particular target, for example, a DNAPL pool at depth, whether or not you'd be able to see that with electrical resistivity. You can answer those questions to a degree before you even go to the field. And I'll show you a tool that can be used to help with that problem. That tool is called SEER. And then we'll wrap up. All right, one more quick question before we really get going. And this one goes to the heart of why we use geophysical methods together in most of our studies here. And I want to get your thoughts on this. So it's best to use geophysical methods together because A, multiple types of information can reduce non-uniqueness. B, different geophysical methods have different strengths and weaknesses. C, not every method works at every site. Or D, all of the above. So what are your thoughts on this question? Cindy, are we getting any results?
Yes, we are. We were. I think people were trying to cheat by copying other people's answers, so I hit it. we've got most of them in. It looks like 1% answered the first. About 12% answered the second option. 2%, third option, and almost 86%. Answered all of the above.
Okay, great. Well, this is one where there is a right answer, and the right answer, of course, is D, all of the above. I suspect some of the folks who answered the earlier options didn't read all the way down. Here, it is very true that multiple types of information can reduce non-uniqueness. So using different geophysical methods together can often reduce the uncertainty in our interpretations. Different geophysical methods do have different strengths and weaknesses. Some methods don't work at sites, for example, where there's clay, for example, ground-penetrating radar. So that wouldn't be an appropriate method to use at a very clay site. Not every method works at every site. So you know, similar to B here, different methods have different strengths and weaknesses, both in terms of the targets and also the site conditions. So the correct answer here is D, all of the above. And that leads us into the geophysical toolbox. The toolbox that we use at my office and in the geophysical community more widely comprises different tools used for work at different scales and from different platforms. We have borehole geophysics, which provides very high resolution information. That information is limited to the vicinity of boreholes. So we can only sample small fractions of an aquifer or a geologic environment with borehole geophysics. Moving up to the crosshole scale, we can image in between wells. So we can image over meters, tens of meters, sometimes up to perhaps 100 meters, but usually just, you know, tens of meters in between wells with crosshole imaging. This provides very detailed, high-resolution information in between wells, similar to CAT scanning in the medical industry applied to the human body. We can apply crosshole imaging in between wells. Moving up scale yet again is surface geophysics, where we can cover very large areas cost-effectively, but the resolution that we can achieve at those scales is not what we could achieve from crosshole imaging or borehole imaging. So you get the sense here that there's a trade-off between scale and resolution, and we'll talk about that more. Within each of these categories, we also have different physics being used for measurements. So with borehole geophysics, we have electromagnetic tools, we have acoustic tools, we have electrical tools, and similarly for cross-hole imaging, we have many of these same different tools that rely on different physics for the measurement. And again, at the surface geophysics scale, we have electrical, seismic, and all the various different physics that we can use to take measurements. And each different type of physical measurement tells us about a different physical property that hopefully we can relate back to properties that you care about, things related to groundwater flow, contaminant transport, water quality conditions, different aquifer materials. So we can work out the framework of aquifer structure, the distribution of fluids in the aquifer perhaps, and answer those questions using different types of physical measurements. In addition to the geophysical tools, within this toolbox, we also have conventional hydrologic measurements. And I can't stress enough how important it is to have those to calibrate, to ground truth, to corroborate our geophysical results. We should never use geophysics in a vacuum, independent of hydrologic measurements. We should use them together in combination and use the hydrologic measurements to help us interpret the geophysical results. So again, I want to drive home the point here that no single tool can work for every problem or site, and there's a synergy between methods. And this really calls for joint interpretation of different geophysical results alongside hydrologic measurements, conventional direct sampling and testing. Here's a relevant quote from Abraham Maslow in 1966. "I suppose it is tempting if the only tool you have is a hammer to treat everything as if it were a nail." And this is something that we need to avoid in applying geophysical solutions to our characterization and monitoring needs. It is very easy if you're proficient in a particular technology, particular tool, or particular method to go back to that method as much as possible because it's comfortable, because you're adept at it. But again, it's important and necessary to tackle many of the problems we're faced with a toolbox sort of approach where you go in with multiple tools to try to sort out, for example, what's lithology versus water quality contrast. Most of the geophysical methods we have are sensitive to more than one thing. That's advantageous in that we can use the same geophysical tool for multiple purposes, but it's a problem in that our geophysical measurements have uncertain, non-unique interpretations. So using multiple methods together can often reduce that non-uniqueness. I won't dig into this table in any great detail. This is a table from a recent publication, and I will provide resources at the end of the talk where you can find downloads to this and other publications at the USGS website. But the point here is that different geophysical methods shown in the left column give you estimates or values of different geophysical properties shown in the second column. So, for example, DC electrical resistivity tells you about electrical resistivity. Induced polarization tells you about chargeability. Seismic refraction or reflection tells you about seismic velocities. Now, these geophysical properties by themselves perhaps are not that useful to you if you're a hydrologist or an engineer. So what you need to do is then translate the geophysical property into a relevant hydrologic property or parameter of interest, and that's in the third column. So seismic velocity can inform about bedrock or lithology. So you can find interfaces with seismic methods very well in many environments. Electrical resistivity is informative of water content, salinity, the pore filling fluid, porosity, and lithology. So again, that's great in that electrical resistivity techniques can tell you about all these different things, but if those different hydrologic properties or parameters are varying spatially at the site where you're working, this becomes a problem because you don't know whether the resistivity contrasts you're looking at are telling you about contrasts in, say, saturation versus salinity. porosity, or lithology. So you need other lines of information to sort that out. One of the lines of information that you can use to begin to sort that out comes from induced polarization. And this is a geophysical method related to electrical resistivity that tells you about chargeability. Whereas electrical resistivity is sensitive to, again, water content, salinity, and so on, chargeability is primarily sensitive to the surface area of the pores or grains, and therefore lithology. It's not really sensitive to the pore-filling fluid, to salinity. It's primarily sensitive instead to lithology. So those two techniques are very complementary to one another. Now in the fourth column, we have indications of how these measurements can be collected. As I said in regard to an earlier slide, most of our measurements can be collected in boreholes using single hole borehole logging, or in between holes with cross-hole imaging, or from land surface with surface geophysics. In many cases, we can also collect these measurements in the lab. So if you want to get very detailed understanding of the relationship between, say, cores taken from a bedrock coring and understand the relationships to the physical properties that you're measuring in the field, you can do that by taking some lab measurements as well. So again, I'm not digging into this table in any great detail, but I want to give you the sense that different geophysical methods inform about different properties, but there's an important translation step between the geophysical property and the hydrologic or engineering properties that you're interested in. And that translation step is not always a simple one. Sometimes it's challenging. I want to give a quick example of a case where geophysical information is used to fill gaps in both space and time. And that's one of the greatest strengths of geophysics compared to conventional direct sampling and measurements, is that we can fill in gaps in space and time very cost effectively. This example comes from a site, a Superfund site in Brandywine, Maryland. This is the Defense Reutilization and Marketing Office, the former DRMO, I should say, associated with Andrews Air Force Base in Brandywine. There's a TCE contaminated groundwater plume at the site. The site includes 12 meters of unconfined aquifer, and the contamination is spread into a residential neighborhood there. A large-scale remediation effort took place, and amendment injections were conducted in several rounds on a 20-foot spacing, and you can see one of the maps from the site here with indications of where those injections occurred. We had an ESTCP demonstration evaluation project to evaluate the use of electrical imaging to track the emplacement of those amendments and the distribution of the amendments over time. Here you see the layout of electrodes and sampling ports at our experimental plot, which was about 20 meters on a side and consisted of seven electrical resistivity tomography and chemical sampling wells, 105 total borehole electrodes, and then some additional sampling wells. We collected geophysical data here for about 2.5 years and had a system set up to autonomously monitor so that we could collect time-lapse data for that whole 2.5 year period with minimal repeated visits to the site just to do site maintenance. The original injections occurred by a direct push in March 2008, and you can see the recipe for the amendment mixtures here. Injections were conducted from 30 feet below ground surface up to almost ground surface, and there was about 950 gallons injected at each location. I'll show here a time-lapse monitoring result in 3D here at the site. Now on the left, you've got the pre-injection baseline image. This is a 3D image of the electrical resistivity structure of the subsurface going down about 11 meters. And what you see is fill material at the surface. This is where material was scraped away to remove soil contamination and then replaced. And then there's the fairly coarse-grained Brandywine formation below that, and then the fine-grained electrically conductive Calvert formation below that. So in that 3D image, you have red over blue over red. So that's conductive over resistive over conductive. So this is telling us about the background lithology prior to the injections. That's our baseline image. And now I'll start a time-lapse sequence of snapshots collected during and after the emplacement of the amendment at two wells within our survey plot. So you see the initial amendment injection showing up as this greenish blob, and then there's a second one next door at the well adjacent. And we're up to about 130 days now, so you see the conductivity increase over time, and then it begins to diminish as the amendment distributes away and dilutes. But after about a year, the conductivity signal starts to increase again, and this is because of biomineralization in the pore space. So this is a signature of the amendment doing what it's supposed to do. So not only have we here monitored the emplacement of the amendment, but we've also monitored its effects, which is valuable information. And we've done this in almost real time. Shown as results at three different sampling ports versus time, we have the bulk conductivity difference from the time series geophysical data shown as squares at three different sampling ports, red, yellow, and green. And then there's quarterly sampling of fluid conductivity at those same sampling ports shown as triangles. So you get the sense that the data coming from the quarterly sampling is, of course, very sparse in time compared to the geophysics, which captures a lot more of the temporal variation in the amendment distribution and ultimately its effects later in time. So this, again, is an example of how we can fill in gaps spatially and temporally with geophysics. The changes in bulk conductivity were compared to the changes in fluid conductivity at those sampling ports. As I stated early on, it's important to have direct information from conventional sampling or hydrologic measurements, and that's what we've got here. Now, by the last geophysical sampling event and the last fluid sampling event, the chain or the relationship between bulk and fluid conductivity had changed. It looked like it was breaking down. And our interpretation of this was that we've got a change in solid phase properties between the second and third fluid sampling event. And that's consistent also with the increase in conductivity seen in the geophysics that can't be explained by a change in fluid conductivity. So what we've got there is biomineralization of precipitation of iron sulfides associated with the amendment's effects. So that's metallic mineral precipitation occurring at the site. So that was an exciting result of this project. And this was consistent with what the contractors were seeing with enhanced microbial activity in the fifth quarter of their work. Sulfide precipitation was occurring as part of a reaction sequence, and black particulate had started to show up in the sampling by that time. So the primary implications of this work were that the amendment was autonomously monitored in four dimensions, so three spatial dimensions plus time. The solid phase alterations were identified through comparison between the geophysics and the more sparse in time and space fluid sampling. We demonstrated the capability of the geophysics to sense this biomineralization, but we're left here with some questions about how can we scale this up? Can this move from research into more widespread practice? And that's where we're going with our ongoing research in this area. But I wanted to give you a sense that geophysics can be used to answer some important problems that we're faced with in the environmental field. As I stated earlier, though, there's always a trade-off between the scale of our investigations and the resolution that we can achieve. The kind of resolution we got in that Brandywine example came from crosshole methods and borehole logging. To upscale this to larger areas where you're covering hundreds of meters or kilometers, you need to begin to look to surface methods or even up to airborne geophysical methods, which are being used more and more for water supply, not so much yet for environmental studies. Okay, and that brings me to now talking about what we're here to talk about today, and that's method selection. Geophysical method selection is a process that involves matching your study goals with the capabilities of different methods. So what we're trying to do here is usually develop a conceptual site model or perhaps a numerical model of some property that you're interested in. So your conceptual site models are your aquifer structure, the contaminant distribution, the hydrologic properties, the groundwater flow directions. All of these things are qualitative, and they can be developed by qualitative interpretation of multiple data types. Sometimes, though, you also want to develop numerical models of, for example, hydraulic conductivity or porosity or contaminant concentration. And geophysics can be used for that as well, but the translation problem that I discussed earlier is perhaps more challenging in that case. No geophysical method is likely to work or will ever work at every site, so there's no silver bullet. And we need to select methods to work at sites consistent with the lithology, the infrastructure, and all the other constraints that we're faced with. Now, we just recently, a couple of years ago, published a spreadsheet tool as a USGS code. It's available from the USGS website, and you see the citation for it here. This is a product of another one of our ESTCP projects. And the goal of this is to provide RPMs, regulators, as well as practitioners with a tool to help evaluate geophysical methods for use at different sites. So if you're looking at a proposal for a geophysical strategy to solve a problem at a site, this is a valuable tool to assess which methods might be useful. And specifically, we're focused here on fractured rock, but we are developing other method selection tools for other environments and other types of aquifer systems. I want to give a caveat here that this is only a first step, and it's meant to be a guide. This is a tool to begin your evaluation. It's not the final answer, and we'll get into, at the end of the talk today, where you go as next steps after using this tool to identify methods that might be promising for application at your sites. This tool, again, is not really intended for geophysical experts, but more for end users, hydrologists, engineers, decision makers. But we want to put some, ammunition in your hand so that you can, come armed to discussions about which tools to use. Here, if a geophysical tool is, not the right one to use at your site, you might have some information here to begin to poke holes in a proposal that pitches using it at that site, or at least to ask the right questions, to think critically about what will work and what won't, what can answer the questions you have and what won't. So this is served from the USGS website, and we have here, in addition to the spreadsheet tool itself, we have also some background information, and we have a training video. I'm going to start that training video here for you in a moment, and we'll just play that for a minute. I won't play the whole thing, but I want to just let you know that these tools are available, and this information is available on our website with the link that you see here, and you'll see again at the end of the talk. This is what the tool looks like. When you open up the spreadsheet, you're faced with a couple of tables on the left, and in these tables, you can indicate the site-specific conditions and your goals. So in that first table in the upper left, you input information about the project and the site parameters. For example, the depth to bedrock, the electrical resistivity of the bedrock, the minimum spacing between wells, the well casing type, the borehole diameter, whether there's cultural interference problems at the site, for example, utilities, pipes, et cetera, underground. So this is where you put in the site parameters, site description that might constrain which methods you can use at the site effectively. The second table is where you input information about your study goals. Now, this spreadsheet tool is focused on fractured rocks, so some of the questions are things like, are you trying to identify discrete fracture network characteristics? Are you trying to identify lithologic contacts, the depths to bedrock? Are you trying to estimate large-scale hydraulic properties? Or are you trying to identify the small-scale effective hydraulic properties? So different questions about your study goals. The spreadsheet produces the table that you see on the right, and you can read this almost like a consumer reports table if you were evaluating different cars for a potential purchase. You see green check marks for where the methods might contribute to the various goals that you've laid out, and you see red X's for methods that are made infeasible by various site conditions that you've entered. And then the spreadsheet produces a green light or a red light depending on whether a method contributes to your goal and is also feasible to work at your site. So then you get this column of red lights and green lights here. And you can click on any one of the methods to get more information. That'll bounce you out to an appendix with some references, a few bullet points on the method, and some other information. And that's what this is what one of those appendices looks like. If you were to click on the link for M22, that's method 22, the optical televiewer, you'll get this information about that tool. So it'll tell you about what the method provides and give a reference to where you can get more information about that method. And then you can click on return to the spreadsheet and it'll go right back to the spreadsheet. I'll just very quickly start up this training video that's available on the USGS website. Oops, let me try that again. And you can either download this video.
Fractured rock geophysical toolbox method selection tool is a spreadsheet-based decision support tool to assist in the selection of geophysical methods for groundwater studies in fractured rock.
Or you can view it right on the USGS webpage and stream it. So the training video will lead you through some information to the spreadsheet tool, how to enter the data in it that you need for your project and site parameters, as well as your study goals. And it'll lead you through the operation of the tool and how to assess the results. All right, so now that you have seen an introduction to the Fractured Rock Geophysical Toolbox Method Selection Tool, what would you do as a next step? Where would you go from here? If you had selected, for example, electrical resistivity as a method to use at your site. And that leads me into the third polling question. And this one pertains to what geophysical methods are capable of. So what are your thoughts on this? What a geophysical method is capable of seeing is a function of what? A, the geophysical technique itself, the underlying physics. B, the survey setup, that is the survey design, the electrode placement, the distance between the boreholes, etc. C, the noise or errors that you will see in the data, which may be a function of the site conditions, the infrastructure at the site, and so on. D, the site-specific geology, or E, all of the above. What are your thoughts on this?
Okay, those votes are coming in. Just a reminder, you might need to shrink down your screen so you can see that poll pod down at the bottom. Okay, well, I hid the results so that everyone couldn't see them, but looks like you all had the right idea. Fred, we've got a couple of votes for the second option for B, and a couple of votes for site-specific geology, D, and the rest are all under E.
All of the above. And that is really the right answer here. What a geophysical method is capable of seeing is a function of the method itself, the physics. It's also a function of the survey setup. You know, you can imagine that if you were using a resistivity setup with electrode spacing of a few meters versus tens of meters, you would see different things. You might be able to see some very fine scale features with a closer spacing. You might be able to see larger scale and deeper features with a larger spacing. It's a function also of the noise or errors. It can be site-specific. It's a function of the site-specific geology. Some methods work better in electrically resistive environments, others in electrically conductive. So the answer is E, all of the above. So that's kind of a complicated answer. And as a result, when you as a hydrologist or an engineer or an environmental chemist, as a decision maker, ask a geophysicist, what is the resolution that I can hope for in your results, the geophysicist usually has a pretty complicated answer. And it all often is hedged based on the site conditions and what you'll be faced with in the field. And that's the best we can really do. We often don't know the resolution we'll achieve with a particular method until we've, you know, gone out to the site and collected the data. That said, there are things that we can do before we go to the field to begin to answer that problem. And that leads us into this next part of my talk, which is desktop feasibility assessment. So when you ask, will a method work, we can do some things before we go to the field. We can assess whether the site-specific conditions that we might expect based on what we know about the site allow for a method to work. So I'm going to address a few different risks here, and then we'll talk about ways to mitigate those risks. Will the method work under site-specific conditions with resolution needed to see targets? That's one of the most important questions that we're faced with. How can we understand what's real versus what's artifact in a geophysical result? If you've interpreted geophysical results before, images of the subsurface, you know that not every feature in there is to be trusted. Some of them are artifacts owing to the limitations of the data or the fact that you can only see so deep. Which regions of the image are reliable versus poorly resolved? We have some strategies to mitigate these risks, and the principal one that I'll talk about today is pre-modeling feasibility assessment before you go to the field. So the idea here is to do what we call synthetic modeling or hypothetical modeling, and this is an exercise in geophysics we refer to commonly as image appraisal. And this is useful for aiding interpretation. It's also useful for designing surveys. The workflow for this process starts with a conceptual model. And this could be kind of a cartoon drawn for the site as to what your site conditions are and what your target is. So here in this hypothetical cartoon, we've got an LNAPL pool on the water table, we've got DNAPL pool down on bedrock, and we've got this three-layer aquifer, basically with an unsaturated zone, a saturated zone, and then a saturated bedrock below. The first step in this feasibility assessment process is to assign properties to that conceptual model. And so we make what we would call a hypothetical or assumed true image of the subsurface. And this would be a cross-section, in this case, of the values of the relevant geophysical property. In the case of DC electrical resistivity surveying, it would be electrical resistivity. So you would assign values to the different parts of that cross-section, to the unsaturated zone, to the LNAPL, to the DNAPL, to the saturated zone, and to the bedrock. And in this case, you see the LNAPL and DNAPL might have similar electrical resistivities, despite being different materials. Then on the computer, you simulate or calculate hypothetical field data from that assumed true geophysical image. So that hypothetical data set then you add noise to be realistic. You could add noise at various levels depending on what you expect at the site. You might need some guidance into that, depending on the site conditions and the geology, but with electrical resistivity, data quality is usually a couple percent up to 10% perhaps. So you add that noise to the data, random noise, and then analyze the data just as we would with real field data. So we use the same sorts of computer codes to analyze this hypothetical data as we would real field data. And that produces what we call an inverted synthetic image. This is the image that would result from that hypothetical conceptual model and some survey that you use in that area. You can then compare the inverted and the true images and ask questions like, is this able to see the targets I've got? So in this kind of cartoon workflow, you can sort of see where the LNAPL is, but the DNAPL being deeper is more or less undetected by this electrical resistivity survey. Now at this stage, you can either revise your survey design and repeat this process, so perhaps by changing your electrode spacing or putting in some downhole electrodes, doing something differently that you have control over, you might get a better result. Or if not, then you might decide that this is time to bag it, to say, no, this isn't going to work, and it's not worth collecting these data at this site. We need to do something different. We need to use a different method, or we need to find another solution that doesn't involve this particular method. And that's then a go, no-go sort of decision. So this is the desktop feasibility assessment workflow. And this is used very commonly in the oil industry. It's used widely in the academic field. It's used at the USGS. And it's used in the geophysical industry for the environmental problems as well, but perhaps not as routinely as it should be. There may be misconceptions that this is an expensive procedure or time-consuming. In fact, some of the tools that are used to analyze data can be used very quickly to run this kind of numerical or computational gut check on what you can see with a geophysical survey. And to make this easier, to facilitate this process for electrical resistivity, we produced a tool which I'll showcase in a few minutes. So, the idea here is that we want from pre-modeling to develop realistic expectations. With this feasibility assessment or pre-modeling workflow, we can predict what you will see based on one or more conceptual models, survey designs, and noise levels. In the workflow that I showed on the previous slide, we had just one conceptual model, but if you have alternative hypotheses for your aquifer structure or for the distribution of your contaminants at your site, then you can input those multiple conceptual models to that workflow and get an idea of the range of possibilities of the geophysical results. Pre-modeling can be performed using many commercially available off-the-shelf and public domain geophysical software packages. Now, some of these are very rigorous numerical models and codes that are used for data analysis, and some are simpler approximate tools, as the one I'll show you in a few minutes. Pre-modeling forms the basis for survey design, go, no-go decisions, and also interpretation. Pre-modeling can tell you about how deep you can see at a site given the geology, given your survey design. So it's used for also like developing some insight into how to interpret the results. And it's not too expensive, and it's not overly burdensome for most problems, for most projects. So in the previous example, can we reliably see or detect the LNAPL, the DNAPL, the geology? If not, can we change our survey to do so? So now I'm going to lead you through a quick Excel-based pre-modeling example. And this is in a software package that we published, I think, just last year at the journal Groundwater, and is available again at the USGS website. This is simple, user-friendly software. It requires nothing beyond Excel to run it. And it'll predict survey outcomes for a limited suite of hypothetical targets and measurement scenarios. So you can't consider any possible survey design. You're kind of limited in this software to just a handful. We have template targets included in the spreadsheet. These include a DNAPL plume, an LNAPL plume, an underground storage tank, and you can modify any of these, so you're not limited to just the spatial configuration of the targets that we've put in the spreadsheet. You can actually modify those manually. And I'll just, again, very quickly show you a training video that's available at the USGS website. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in this or go through the whole video, but I want to give you a sense that you can go to our website to get the resources to do this yourself or have people you work with or who work for you do this themselves. Okay. So this training video leads you through a background to geophysics, and then it shows you around the spreadsheet where here's the DNAPL pool. This is your hypothetical resistivity structure in the top, and the bottom is the image that would result from a survey. The video talks a little bit about how data are collected, how the physics underlying the measurements plays a role in what you can see, and some of the other issues that I've introduced you to today in this presentation. So here you can simulate the data and the result that would be achieved for that hypothetical DNAPL plume, and you can change around the electrode spacing, the resistivity structure of the subsurface, and try to change around the result to achieve a better one by modifying your survey geometry, by adding borehole electrodes, and by going through this process again and again. The video leads you through the various steps that I've introduced you to before and gives you a walkthrough of an example of the software. So how does this work? I'm not going to dig into the math underlying this today, but this is an approximation, and I want to drive home that fact here in this slide. That this is, again, kind of it's a next step from the Fractured Rock Geophysical Toolbox, but it's not the final best answer as to whether or not a method is going to work. There are more rigorous software packages out there that a practicing geophysicist could use to come up with a pre-modeling result for a survey design. But this is a really good place to start, especially if you don't have a lot of experience with geophysics. It's easy to start up, and you can have results very quickly. So this is just a quick walkthrough of imaging a DNAPL plume in the SEER software, the Scenario Evaluator for Electrical Resistivity. You start off with a conceptual model. You turn that into a true conductivity model. So we have three conductivity values here, one for the vadose zone, one for the DNAPL, and one for the saturated zone. We can estimate that true conductivity from the physical properties that we assume, like porosity, saturation, and the resistivity of the DNAPL and the native pore fluid. The SEER spreadsheet will turn that true conductivity, that hypothetical distribution of conductivity or resistivity, into an electrical resistivity image. That's the hypothetical result. And then you can compare and ask, did we see that DNAPL plume? Here, in this example, you do see it, but as you can tell, it's smeared out. It's kind of blurry and blunted, and you don't get the fine scale details of the plume. You just get its general placement. If you add borehole electrodes, that is downhole electrodes, you can do a lot better. You can start to delineate the edges of the plume and get a better sense of its overall shape. So using this pre-modeling workflow, you can start to ask questions and answer questions about the survey geometry and whether or not it might be worthwhile to add some direct push electrodes into the survey. And you can answer the go, no-go decision. Does pre-modeling suggest the target is sufficiently resolvable with electrical imaging to go forward with a geophysical field campaign? And this is what it looks like in the spreadsheet itself. Now, we've been talking here about just simple three-value electrical resistivity cross-sections. But in fact, geology is spatially variable, and geophysical properties are, as a result, spatially variable. So if we want to consider heterogeneity, spatial variability in the geophysical properties, we can do that in CR2. You can put in some heterogeneity in the background resistivity structure, and then see if you can still see that DNAPL. And in this case, what you would find is the DNAPL is exceedingly difficult to find if you add in some heterogeneity to that that geologic cross-section. So here with the surface electrodes, the DNAPL is all but hidden by that geologic heterogeneity. With the borehole electrodes, you might get some sense of where it is, but it's very difficult, and you do not get a sense of its overall shape or extent. So in summary, to wrap up, method selection involves identifying methods to achieve study objectives under site-specific constraints. Multiple methods are usually the way to go. The Fractured Rock Geophysical Toolbox method selection tool is a useful place to get started with this kind of process for identifying methods. Pre-modeling is the next step, and that's something that you do before going to the field. You conduct a desktop feasibility assessment to ask questions about whether the target or targets can be resolved given site-specific conditions, the limitations associated with the methods and the underlying physics of the methods, the survey geometries that you can apply, and so on. And for this problem, the Scenario Evaluator for Electrical Resistivity, the SEER tool, is a useful next step. So I'm going to wrap up here with a polling question before going into a list of resources that are available to you. And that's about your interests in what we can do to better serve this community here at USGS. Would you be more interested in a groundwater surface water method selection tool similar to the fractured rock tool, or more tools like SEER, but for other geophysical methods so that you could evaluate, say, seismic methods or electromagnetic methods or temperature methods for these and other problems? Or would you be more interested in a geophysical best practices document with case studies and sample data, or more online training videos? Because we can't really do everything all the time here, and we do need to focus our energies, and we want to do that in a way that serves the community. So any feedback here would be appreciated.
Cindy? All right. We've got some answers coming in, Fred. Looks like people are interested in all of these options.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear. We'll get the final tap.
We've got about 20% for each of the first two, close to 60% for best practices document with case studies and sample data, and wavering around 6-7% for more online training videos.
Okay, great. Great. Well, that's good feedback, and we'll take that to heart. Thank you. And I'll just wrap up by pointing you toward some resources online on these and other codes and other places to look for information. So there's a link here to the Fractured Rock Geophysical Toolbox page at USGS, to the SEER page. These include the videos and the papers, at least the text of the papers that accompany the publications for those pieces of software. We contributed material to the EnviroWiki, along with Rutgers University, and that's a good place to get background information on geophysical tools. And also working with Rutgers University, we've been involved in helping with this askageophysicist.net forum, where you can pose questions to practicing geophysicists about geophysics and its use at different sites. So it's a good place to go for additional information. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your time today and the opportunity to talk to you, and I hope there's time for questions.
We might squeeze in a question or two real quick, Fred, but we're coming up close to 2 o'clock. I just want to point out to everyone who, if you haven't found it yet, over on the related URLs on the right-hand side, you can also see links to these pages. And also on the CLUIN webinar, on the seminar homepage where you registered and joined the webinar, you can also find these links there. So, Fred, let me just ask you a couple of quick questions about the Brandywine site. Someone asked if you confirmed the mineralization through sampling. I'm guessing that was, or were you looking for pyrite? And also, how much or what kind of cost benefits do you see to doing autonomous monitoring?
Those are both good questions. Regarding the autonomous monitoring, I think this is going to be very site-dependent. That was a technology demonstration, and as we were demonstrating the technology, it was also being refined and adapted. It's come a long way since we started that study. When we started the study, it was all we could do to get an image every day or two, but by the end, we could get images every 40 minutes, and the results could be delivered in real time to people in the field. So I think this is a wide open area. I think we'll see geophysics, just like we're seeing all other types of information, being served more quickly, over phones even, to people who need it, in real time. So I think we're going to see those costs come down to where we can do these kinds of studies for very low cost. Regarding the geochemistry at that site, if the folks asking the question could drop me an email, I can refer you to the Rutgers team who can answer that better than I can. We do have a paper. We're working on that now, and we collected some soil cores for that, and they were doing a solid phase chemistry for that. But that paper is still in the works, so I'm not going to talk about it a whole lot today.
Okay, thanks, Fred. One more quick question. So if someone is trying to use the FRGT method selection tool, if they don't have some site-specific values, like if they don't know their bedrock resistivity, are there default values you can use on there?
That's a good question. We do have an appendix in there, and there are some also drop-downs for different lithology types. So, there are some resources even in the spreadsheet and the appendices where you can get information about some of those values. Otherwise, we have references or citations to textbooks where there are tables that you can get values that really are rock type dependent. So you can see ranges of resistivity, seismic velocity, and so forth.
Perfect. Thank you, Fred. And I think now we're at 2:00, so we're going to have to wrap this up. I'm afraid we don't have time for more questions. But I do want to thank you, Fred, and also remind our speakers that this was the third of a series of 3 geophysics webinars. We do have links to those other webinars available. There was one on environmental geophysical methods and one on borehole geophysical methods that were delivered 2 weeks ago. You can watch all of those online on Cluin. And you'll see the links to those webinars, again, from the Cluin seminar homepage. We invite you to find Cluin on social media and sign up for our free monthly TechDirect newsletter to learn about new webinars and resources related to hazardous waste site cleanup. Thank you again for joining our webinar today. Slides and other items related to the session can be found on that seminar resources page. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. You'll also find information for our speakers and organizers on the presentation page, as noted earlier. If you have questions for Fred, you can contact him on the information on that page. And lastly, I'd like to ask that you take a brief moment to fill out the online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session, both of the content covered and the method of delivery. We will share that information with our speaker, and that will help us to build future training. Although we don't offer PDHs or CEUs for our webinars, you can save or print a participation certificate after you submit that feedback form for the event. Just make sure that you check the box at the bottom of the form to certify that you were here for or watched the entire archive. You'll find that sometimes you can use that form to get PDHs or CEUs from your accrediting institution. And if you participated as a group, each person can fill out that online feedback form to get their own certificate. Lastly, this session was recorded. In the future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today as part of the archive. You'll automatically receive an email once that archive is available. That's the end of our final reminders. Thank you for joining on today's session. I hope you found this to be a valuable use of your time, and we'll see you on a future webinar. This is the formal conclusion